I certainly don't think there isn't a role for private providers or NGOs, but I think it's naive to believe that an entire country or society can be run without having the state on board.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. An increasing number of the world's poorest people live in middle-income countries like India. And given that these countries often have fast-growing, relatively stable economies and are not primary targets for state aid, what else should we be doing to help the poorest citizens? It's a question we'll have to answer if we're going to eradicate extreme poverty by 2030 and therefore meet the challenge set by the Sustainable Development Goals. Rohini Pandey, incoming director of the Economic Growth Centre at Yale, argues that the key to helping these citizens will be when these states provide what she and her co-author Lucy Page call invisible infrastructure. And she joins us today to explain what this would be and why it matters. Rohini, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks, Tim.
We're having this conversation partly because the news is good. The reduction in extreme poverty, thanks to growth and aid, has been dramatic. But now we find large numbers of the world's poorest people in what you've called high-poverty, middle-income countries. So which countries are we talking about here?
So, Tim, a couple of the countries we're talking about are, I think, what you think of as the usual suspects, countries like India and Nigeria. There are a couple of others that you may have thought have moved out of this category, like China, but are still in there. It also includes Indonesia. And importantly, there's a growing set of countries that are rising into the ranks of middle income. So, for instance, Pakistan and Bangladesh feature in this, which are now countries that are described middle income or lower middle income using the World Bank definition. So it's largely a set of countries across South and East Asia and a couple in Africa at this stage.
On average, incomes in these countries are going up, but not always, not uniformly. That also means aid is increasingly targeted elsewhere. Do we have to think of new strategies to help the poorest people in these countries?
So I think as any well-versed development economist will tell you, anything I would call a new strategy has already been tried out sometime over the last couple of centuries. So I would certainly not be so arrogant to think of new strategies. But what I would argue is that we should recognize that the changing geography of poverty means that it's not clear we want to be targeting the nation state using the typical criteria of income. And so a lot of aid, for instance, has historically been focused on assuming that poor people live in poor countries. And that's increasingly not the case. Now, you can have poverty forecasts which suggest that by 2030, the poor will again be concentrated in fragile, conflict-ridden poor countries, but that assumes a lot about the nature of growth. And I think one thing we are learning is the nature of growth is changing. The kind of rises in inequality that we are seeing in Europe and the US are also mirrored by very high increases in wealth concentration in countries like China and India. So it's not clear that growth is going to be the tide that's going to lift all the remaining boats in countries like India and a lot of South Asia. In addition, the low-skilled manufacturing miracle that helped drive a lot of people out of poverty in China is again changing. We're not seeing manufacturing growth increase the same way. This is something that my colleague Danny Roderick has described as premature deindustrialization that we are seeing in a number of middle-income countries. So I think it's not enough to target on countries anymore. It's also, I think, inadequate to place our forecasts of where poverty would be on assumptions of growth that seem to be increasingly incorrect. So I think one way we should be thinking about it is where can you get the most bang for your buck? So when and where can you both leverage domestic state resources and aid, recognizing that these are very small drops in the bucket, and ask how can you actually put them in the right place in order to leverage the largest gains in terms of reducing the number of people in poverty?
So your prescription from this, as I said in the introduction, is what you have termed invisible infrastructure. What precisely are you talking about here, and why is it different from visible infrastructure?
It's very complementary to visible infrastructure, and I think one reason for actually using the word infrastructure is to resonate a lot with, say, lending agencies, where if you still look at it, the largest fractions of their loans to low-income countries are around often infrastructure. So what do? You build a road or you build a dam, and then you do some cost-benefit analysis where you assume so much of the benefits will go to the poor. Invisible infrastructure is what we are missing out here. It's everything that will take for a woman to be able to walk out of the house in the middle of the night and walk on a road near her house, even if it's built. Or it's everything that's going to take for a poor person to actually be able to make sure that the canal from the dam doesn't get diverted to the farms of the rich people. And so I think of invisible infrastructure as the necessary complement that helps poor get access to visible infrastructure. And what this involves is that entire chain of the state that is engaged in completing the last mile of delivery, but is trying to do it in a way that recognizes that getting services to the citizens or them being able to access infrastructure requires us to be able to recognize that there's a whole human chain of providers, and we need to align their incentives with those of who we are trying to reach. And that's what I think of the invisible infrastructure, which complements very much this idea that often what the poor need is access to services and infrastructure.
With this, you seem to be arguing for a larger role for the state in poverty reduction. So what are the advantages in these places of the state that an NGO or a private organization doesn't have?
I'm not sure I'm arguing for a larger role. I'm arguing for a central role. Mm-hmm. And I think the two reasons I'm arguing for a central role. First, I think, is something that we often forget, which is a normative argument, which is who has the right to decide on behalf of citizens what they have and how they should get it. And I think ultimately that comes back to this question of who is being given the right by citizens, and it is the domestic state. And so I think an important reason why the state has to play a role is that they are the ones whom citizens are giving the rights to. And you see that in endless surveys. In fact, we talk often about things like more corruption in low-income countries, but for instance, if you look at the levels of trust, the levels of trust in government in low-income countries are, similar to those in rich countries. And if anything, you look at the decline in trust in the government in a country like the US, it probably very often is higher than that in the US. So I think the first argument is purely normative. The second is, and this goes back to state as the group that has the monopoly of violence. So very much, again, if you think of the classic services that citizens need are security, our services, redistribution, the state is the one that has the right to provide it. And finally, I think the breadth that the state has is going to be very rarely something that an NGO will achieve. So I certainly don't think there isn't a role for private providers or NGOs, but I think it's naive to believe that an entire country or society can be run without having the state on board.
That message may be unpopular to some of the people that hear it, because at the moment, a lot of help for the poor deliberately bypasses the state because of the inefficiency of institutions or the potential for corruption. So in the short term, is it feasible for donors or NGOs to endorse that central role for the state?
An interesting example is to think about what happened with the spread of Ebola. So when you often talk to people on the ground, what they would tell you is a lot of the investments in Africa in health, which were donor-driven, were very much what they would call vertical investments. You decide you want to get rid of a particular virus or a particular disease, and you deliver an entire infrastructure very much focused on, let's say, making sure the last child gets a polio vaccine. And what that meant is that when you have just a broad-based health epidemic, where what you need is horizontal infrastructure, you just didn't have it. You didn't have that broad-based health system which is needed to deal with this global health epidemic. So I think some of this is recognizing that a lot of what the state provides are goods which have very large externalities, which, go across the state. It's going to be very hard for an NGO or someone else to have that breadth to be able to account for those externalities, to put in place a statewide system. Climate change is another classic example. It's going to be very hard for an NGO in a state to fight climate change. So there may be corruption, but I think once you start thinking of the nature of what you want to provide, it may be that we have to go through the state or go through a body that is going to be thinking of a much larger public group than an NGO will, and that's just the nature of the beast. The question is not, can we bypass it because there's corruption? We have to recognize we have to make this work, and then the question is, how do we make it work?
Central to how you make it work is what you described in the paper as the human chain. What is this?
So I think the human chain is really picking up this idea that pretty much every governance structure across the world is a delegated governance structure. I may go to the election and vote in my local legislator, or I might even vote in for the president of the country, but the president of the country is not going to sit down and make sure that my child gets the right inputs in school. he or she is going to delegate it down through an intricate series of both political and bureaucratic mechanisms, possibly including also private players, before I actually get in the school of my child the services that she needs. In order for that whole system to work, we need to get this human chain of providers to somehow have incentives that are aligned with those of the person deciding the policy on one side and those receiving it on the other. And we need the kind of information flows that make it possible for people's actions to get monitored. And so I think it's very much recognizing the fact that no matter how much technology you put in place and no matter how much of the corruption you try to deal with by getting rid of layers of governance and saying we'll just send money directly to the poor by mobile phones, that poor person is still going to need a place to go and cash out that money. And that's going to require us to think a lot, for instance, in that case, about the incentives of the person who's cashing out someone's mobile money at, say, an M-Pesa store in Kenya.
Sounds like a lot of work with a lot of different interests involved. Practically, is this going to be deliverable?
Practically, has it been deliverable? And yes, it has in some cases. If we think about just the historic setting up of bureaucratic systems, that has been a classic case of delivering this. I think the interesting question to me more is not whether it can be delivered, but how do you actually make it deliver the best? There's always this question as to get a dollar to a poor person, how much do we have to spend? Do we have to spend $4 or do we have to spend $2? And I think that's really where the art now is. The art is trying to think about how do we leverage new advances in technology? How do we leverage things like people's social preferences or altruism in selecting and who is going to be the provider to start doing a better job of the delivery process? And I think key to doing that is to not think of it as this huge technocratic enterprise, but recognize that people involved, there's politics involved, it's going to be messy. But I think we have some tools, at least in economics, to start thinking about how to do this.
One of the tools that you emphasize is the role of democracy to make this human chain accountable to the people that it's meant to be helping. Is this not a very rosy view of democracy, especially considering the problems that we have in large democratic processes at the moment, vote buying, populism, things like ethnic voting?
Absolutely. I mean, we are sitting here in London with, Brexit looming large. So I'm sure you're thinking about many of the same issues. I think it's exactly the same issues. I think it's exactly the same issues that we face in US or Europe. I think it's exactly the same specters of thinking about populism, which is why I think what's important is we have to recognize that this is not a technocratic problem. Some of this is, in the end, it's about thinking about economic justice. And thinking about economic justice is to recognize that somewhere we're putting a normative foot forward. And we are saying, for instance, that we believe that citizens should have a say in what happens. Democracy seems to be what most people still prefer relative to other forms of governance. And we just need to figure out how to make it work. It's not that it's going to be easy or hard. And I think what it requires us to do is to recognize that perhaps to make democracy work better, democracy works worse when there is a lot of inequality in society. And so perhaps what this is an argument for is trying to think about how do we actually put in place systems to reduce inequality.
The example that you use in the paper is workfare reform in India, which is a huge program and very complex. What were the successes and the failures from that? What have we learned from that?
Yeah, so in the paper, I talk about the Mahatma Gandhi National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme, which is, as of now, the largest federal workfare program. Under this, every rural household in India is eligible for 100 days daily payment for work, typically on manual labor projects. And this is really, I think, the primary form of social insurance that exists. It's certainly when it started, I think most estimates suggested that 30 to 40% of the resources being sent would disappear through corruption. I think it's been a success on a couple of measures. First, transparency. Right from the start, the ministry put in place a system where you could, on a website, really go down and identify which project was going on, who was supposed to have gotten resources. And I think this became an important form for civil society to engage in social auditing. A second thing it did was it's been good at leveraging digital technology. So it's one of the first programs where it moved completely towards ensuring that people get paid into their bank account, that they actually removed some of the tiers involved in financing by making a digital payment. So I think that, again, has been a success. Where it's been less of a success right now is in actually being responsive to demand. I think the projects still very much come when someone decides to release it, not necessarily when there is need. And I think the big other concern is payment delays. It's a long process for people to get paid. But all that said, I think, you know, it's a good example of both how to provide a workfare program. And as you asked, what's a success story? I mean, I think when it started, many people have thought it's crazy to assume that the government can actually provide this kind of service. It did. Contrast it to now, what I think is the flavor of the month, which is sort of UBI or kind of pure cash transfers. This is a case where the payment is conditional. It's conditional on work. And one thing I have found in work with colleagues that this has been extremely important in enabling women to be able to both access work, but also when you give them direct access to their payments, they're able to use it both to continue sustain work outside the house. But over time, and I think this is the most important thing, it has changed in those villages beliefs and norms about the appropriate role for women and whether they can and should go out and work. And so I think, again, it's important to think that while from a NGO perspective, it might seem that the best way to help the poor is just to transfer $1.90 to their mobile phone. If you live in a society with, you know, restrictive norms and other constraints, it's also interesting to think about how do you design policies to address those constraints that individuals face. And there you might find that something that seems like a bulkier program, in this case, tying payments to work, actually is important because it achieves another purpose, which is it empowers women.
And yet, we talked at the beginning about the Sustainable Development Goals. The goal for that is just over 10 years away. Changing beliefs and norms, building infrastructure, it takes a long time. Is what we're talking about something that will be reflected in benefits further down the road? Is it useful tying it to the Sustainable Development Goals at all?
I don't know what takes time and what doesn't. I think a lot of, for instance, populist movements that have risen around the world have risen much faster than we thought they should. So the changes, for instance, that we are seeing in beliefs and norms have happened relatively fast. So I think just as democracy or institution can be eroded very fast, it can possibly also be built quite fast. I'm not worried about that. I think perhaps more the concern is when a lot of these SDGs were written, I think climate change wasn't as much front and center as it should have been. And so, you know, to the extent that we still in some ways think of growth as an incredibly important lever for poverty reduction, as we start recognizing the cost of economic growth, for instance, for climate change, how are we going to think about that? Those two seem to me really important challenges in thinking about what lies ahead in the next decade.
Rohini, thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
The paper we've been talking about is called Ending Global Poverty, Why Money Isn't Enough. And the authors are Lucy Page and Rohini Pandey. And it was published in the Journal of Economic Perspectives in fall 2018, if you want to download it.
This has been a VoxDev Talk. You can find more of our episodes at voxdev.org, and don't forget to subscribe to VoxDev Talks on your podcast platform.